This is a key to getting the maximum benefit out of any sort of practice, from private or group lessons to solitary practice and even games or competitions. Whatever you are doing, focus on it. A graduate student who worked with me at Florida State, Cole Armstrong, described high school golfers developing this sort of focus. At some point around their sophomore years, they began to understand what it meant to engage in purposeful practice rather than just practice. In his dissertation, Cole quoted one high school golfer explaining when and how the shift occurred in his approach to practice. "I can think about a specific point, sophomore year. My coach came up to me on the range and said, 'Justin, what are you doing?' I was hitting balls and said, 'I'm practicing for the tournament.' And he said, 'No, you're not. I've been watching you. You're just hitting balls. You're not really doing a routine or anything.' So we had a conversation, and like you said, we started a routine, a practice routine. And from then on, I really started to practice where it was a conscious action, working towards a specific goal, not just hit balls or putt." Learning to engage in this way, consciously developing and refining your skills, is one of the most powerful ways to improve the effectiveness of your practice. The American swimmer Natalie Coughlin once described her own version of this sort of aha moment. Over her career, she won a total of 12 Olympic medals, an accomplishment that tied her with two others for the most Olympic medals ever won by a female swimmer. While she was always a very good swimmer, she didn't become great until she learned to focus throughout her practice. For much of her early swimming career, she would pass the time she spent swimming laps by daydreaming. This is common not just with swimmers, but also with runners and all the other types of endurance athletes who spend hours and hours every week putting in the distances needed to build their stamina. Stroke, 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 over and over again for hours on end. It's hard not to get bored and just zone out, letting your mind wander far outside the pool. And this is what Coughlin did. But at some point, while she was competing for the University of California, Berkeley, Coughlin realized that she'd been wasting a major opportunity during those hours she spent swimming laps. Instead of letting her mind wander, she could be focusing on her technique, trying to make each stroke as close to perfect as possible. In particular, she could be working on sharpening her mental representations of her stroke, figuring out exactly how her body feels during a perfect stroke. Once she had a clear idea of what that ideal stroke felt like, she could notice when she deviated from that ideal, perhaps when she was tired or when she was approaching a turn, and then work on ways to minimize those deviations and keep her strokes as close to ideal as possible. From then on, Coughlin made a point of staying engaged in what she was doing, using the time spent swimming laps to improve her form. It was only when she began doing this that she really started to see improvement in her times, and the more focused on her form in her training, the more success she had in her meets. Nor is Coughlin an isolated example. After carrying out extended study of Olympic swimmers, the researcher Daniel Chambliss concluded that the key to excellence in swimming lay in maintaining close attention to every detail of performance. Each one, done correctly, time and again, until excellence in every detail becomes a firmly ingrained habit. This is the recipe for maximum improvement from your practice. Even in those sports such as bodybuilding or long-distance running, where much of the practice consists of seemingly mindless, repetitive actions, paying attention, performing those actions the right way, will lead to greater improvement. Researchers who have studied long-distance runners have found that amateurs tend to daydream or think about more pleasant subjects to take their minds off the pain and strain of their running, while elite and long-distance runners remain attuned to their bodies so that they can find the optimal pace and make adjustments to maintain the best pace throughout the whole race. In bodybuilding or weightlifting, if you are going to attempt to lift a weight at the maximum of your current ability, you need to prepare before the lift and be completely focused during the lift. Any activity at the limits of your ability will require full concentration and effort. And, of course, in fields where strength and endurance are not so important, intellectual activities, musical performance, art, and so on, there is little point at all to practicing if you don't focus. Maintaining this sort of focus is hard work, however, even for experts who have been doing it for years. As I noted in Chapter 4, the violin students I studied at the Berlin Academy found their training so tiring that they would often take a midday nap between their morning and afternoon practice sessions. People who are just learning to focus on their practice won't be able to maintain it for several hours. Instead, they'll need to start out with much shorter sessions and gradually work up. The advice I offered to Per Homloff in this area can be applied to just about anyone who is getting started on deliberate practice. Focus and concentration are crucial, I wrote, so shorter training sessions with clearer goals are the best way to develop new skills faster. It is better to train at 100% effort for less time than at 70% effort for a longer period. Once you find you can no longer focus effectively, end the session. And make sure you get enough sleep so that you can train with maximum concentration. Per took my advice. He had arranged to get personal sessions with his sensei. He was doing shorter training sessions, but at a higher level of concentration, and he was getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night and a nap after lunch. He had passed his green belt test, and his next goal was the blue belt. At 70 years old, he was halfway to black belt. And as long as he stayed injury-free, he was confident he could reach that goal before he turned 80. If you don't have a teacher. The last time we encountered Benjamin Franklin in this book, he was playing chess for hours and hours, but never really getting any better. This provided us with an excellent example of how not to practice. Just doing the same thing over and over again without any focused step-by-step plan for improvement. But Franklin was far more than a chess player, of course. He was a scientist, inventor, diplomat, publisher, and a writer whose words are still read more than 2 centuries later. So let us give equal time to an area in which he did much better than he did in chess. Early in his autobiography, Franklin describes how as a young man he worked to improve his writing. The education he had received as a child had left him, by his own assessment, not much more than an average writer. Then he ran across an issue of the British magazine The Spectator and found himself impressed by the quality of the writing in its pages. Franklin decided that he would like to write that well, but he had no one to teach him how. What could he do? He came up with a series of clever techniques aimed at teaching himself how to write as well as the writers of The Spectator. He first set out to see how closely he could reproduce the sentences in an article once he had forgotten their exact wording. So he chose several of the articles whose writing he admired and wrote down short descriptions of the content of each sentence, just enough to remind him what the sentence was about. After several days, he tried to reproduce the articles from the hints he had written down. His goal was not so much to produce a word-for-word replica of the articles, as to create his own articles that were as detailed and well-written as the original. Having written his reproductions, he went back to the original articles, compared them with his own efforts, and corrected his versions where necessary. This taught him to express ideas clearly and cogently. The biggest problem he discovered from these exercises was that his vocabulary was not nearly as large as those of the writers of The Spectator. It wasn't that he didn't know the words, but rather that he didn't have them at his fingertips when he was writing. To fix this, he came up with a variation of his first exercise. He decided that writing poetry would force him to come up with a plethora of different words that he might not normally think of because of the need to fit the poem's rhythm and the rhyming pattern. So he took some of The Spectator's articles and transformed them into verse. Then, after waiting long enough that his memory of the original wording had faded, he would transform the poems back into prose. This got him into the habit of finding just the right word and increased the number of words he could call up quickly from his memory. Finally, Franklin worked on the overall structure and logic of his writing. Once again, he worked with articles from The Spectator and wrote hints for each sentence. But this time he wrote the hints on separate pieces of paper and then jumbled them so that they were completely out of order. Then he waited long enough that not only had he forgotten the wording of the sentences in the original articles, but he had also forgotten their order, and he tried, once again, to reproduce the articles. He would take the jumbled hints from one article and arrange them in what he thought was the most logical order, then write sentences from each hint, and compare the result with the original article. The exercise forced him to think carefully about how to order the thoughts in a piece of writing. If he found places where he'd failed to order his thoughts as well as the original writer, he would correct his work and try to learn from his mistakes. In his typically humble way, Franklin recalled in his autobiography how he could tell that the practice was having its desired effect. "I sometimes had the pleasure of fancying that, in certain particulars of small import, I had been lucky enough to improve the method or the language, and this encouraged me to think I might possibly in time come to be a tolerable English writer, of which I was extremely ambitious." Franklin was too modest, of course. He went on to become one of the most admired writers of early America, with Poor Richard's Almanac, and later his autobiography becoming classics of American literature. Franklin solved a problem, wanting to improve, but having no one to teach him how, which many people face from time to time. Maybe you can't afford a teacher, or there is no one easily accessible to teach what you want to learn. Maybe you're interested in improving in some area where there are no experts, or at least no teachers. Whatever the reasons are, it is still possible to improve if you follow some basic principles from deliberate practice, many of which Franklin seems to have intuited on his own. The hallmark of purposeful or deliberate practice is that you try to do something you cannot do, that takes you out of your comfort zone, and that you practice it over and over again, focusing on exactly how you are doing it, where you are falling short, and how you can get better. Real life, our jobs, our schooling, our hobbies, seldom gives us the opportunity for this sort of focused repetition, so in order to improve, we must manufacture our own opportunities. Franklin did it with his exercises, each focused on a particular facet of writing. Much of what a good teacher or coach will do is to develop such exercises for you, designed specifically to help you improve the particular skill you are focused on at the moment. But without a teacher, you must come up with your own exercises. Fortunately, we live in a time when it is easy to go to the internet and find training techniques for the most common skills that people are interested in, and quite a few that are not so common at all. Want to improve your puck handling skills in hockey? It's on the internet. Want to be a better writer? On the internet. To solve a Rubik's Cube really fast? Internet. Of course, you have to be careful about the advice. The internet offers just about everything except quality control. But you can get some good ideas and tips. Try them out and see what works best for you. But not everything is on the internet, and the things that are may not fit exactly what you're trying to do or may not be practical. Some of the most challenging skills to practice, for instance, are those that involve interacting with other people. It's easy enough to sit in your room spinning a Rubik's Cube faster and faster, or to go to a driving range and practice hitting with your woods. But what if your skill requires a partner or an audience? Devising an effective way to practice such a skill can require some creativity. Another professor at Florida State University who worked with ESL, English as a Second Language, students, told me about a student of his who went to the mall and stopped a number of shoppers, asking each the same question. In this way, she was able to hear similar answers over and over again, and that repetition made it easier for her to understand the words being spoken by native speakers at full speed. If she had asked different questions each time, it's likely that her comprehension would have improved little, if at all. Other students who were trying to improve their English would watch the same English movies with subtitles over and over again, covering the subtitles and trying to understand what was being said. To check their comprehension, they would uncover the subtitles. By listening to the same dialogue over and over, They improved their ability to understand English much more quickly than if they'd simply watched a number of different movies. Note that these students weren't simply doing the same thing over and over again. They were paying attention to what they got wrong each time and correcting it. This is purposeful practice. It does no good to do the same thing over and over again mindlessly. The purpose of the repetition is to figure out where your weaknesses are and focus on getting better in those areas, trying different methods to improve until you find something that works. One of my favorite examples of this sort of clever, self-designed practice technique was described to me by a student at a circus school in Rio de Janeiro. He was training to be a ringmaster, and his problem was how to keep the audience interested during a show. Besides introducing various circus acts, the ringmaster must be ready to fill up any empty time between acts if there is some sort of delay in presenting the next act. But no one was going to let this student practice his technique with live audiences. So he came up with an idea. He went to downtown Rio and struck up conversations with people who were going home during rush hour. Most of them were in a hurry, so he had to work to keep them interested enough to stay and listen to what he had to say. In doing so, he got to practice using his voice and body language to draw attention to himself, and using pauses that were long enough, but not too long, to create dramatic tension. What struck me most, though, was how deliberate he was about it. He used his watch to time exactly how long he could keep each conversation going. He spent a couple of hours each day doing this, taking notes about which techniques worked best and which didn't work at all. Comedians do something very similar. There is a reason that most of them have spent time in stand-up comedy clubs. They get a chance to try out their material and their delivery, and they get immediate feedback from the audience. Either the jokes work or they don't. And they can come back night after night, honing their material, getting rid of what doesn't work and making what does work even better. Even established comedians will often return to stand-up clubs to try out new routines or simply brush up on their delivery. To effectively practice a skill without a teacher, it helps to keep in mind three F's: focus, feedback, fix it. Break the skill down into components that you can do repeatedly and analyze effectively. Determine your weaknesses and figure out ways to address them. The ringmaster, the ESL students, and Ben Franklin all exemplified this approach. Franklin's approach also offers an excellent template for developing mental representations when you have little or no input from instructors. When he analyzed the writing in The Spectator and figured out what made it good, he was, although he didn't think of it in these terms, creating a mental representation that he could use to guide his own work. The more he practiced, the more highly developed his mental representations became, until he could write at the level of The Spectator without having a concrete example in front of him. He had internalized good writing, which is just another way of saying that he had built mental representations that captured its salient features. Ironically, this is exactly what Franklin failed to do as a chess player. With writing, he studied the work of experts and tried to reproduce it. When he failed to reproduce it well enough, he would take another look at it and figure out what he had missed so that he would do better the next time. But this is exactly how chess players improve most effectively: by studying the games of grandmasters, trying to reproduce them move by move, and when they choose a move that is different from what the grandmaster chose, studying the position again to see what they missed. Franklin could not apply this technique to chess, however, because he had no easy access to the games of masters. Almost all of them were in Europe, and at the time there were no books with their collected games for him to study. If he had had some way to study the masters' games, he might well have become one of the best chess players of his generation. He was certainly one of its best writers. We can build effective mental representations in many areas with a similar technique. In music, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's father taught him to compose in part by having him study some of the era's best composers and copy their work. And in art, aspiring artists have long developed their skills by copying the paintings and sculptures of the masters. Indeed, in some cases, they have done this in a way very similar to the technique Franklin used to improve his writing. That is, by studying a piece of art by a master, attempting to reproduce it from memory, and then comparing the finished product with the original in order to discover the differences and correct them. Some artists even become so good at copying that they can make their living as forgers. But that is not usually the point of this exercise. Artists don't want to produce artwork that looks like someone else's. They want to develop the skills and mental representations that make expertise possible, and use that expertise to convey their own artistic vision. Despite the first word in the term mental representation, pure mental analysis is not nearly enough. We can only form effective mental representations when we try to reproduce what the expert performer can do, fail, figure out why we failed, try again, and repeat, over and over again. Successful mental representations are inextricably tied to actions, not just thoughts, and it is the extended practice aimed at reproducing the original product that will produce the mental representations we seek. Getting past plateaus. In 2005, a young journalist named Joshua Foer came to Tallahassee to interview me about an article he was writing about memory competitions. These are the sorts of events that I mentioned earlier, where people compete to see who can recall the most digits, who can memorize a random collection of playing cards most quickly, and other similar feats. During our discussions, Josh mentioned that he was thinking about competing himself in order to get a first-person perspective, and that he was going to start training under a top-ranked memory competitor, Ed Cook. There was even some vague talk about a book he might write on his experiences in these competitions. Before Josh began working with Cook, my graduate students and I tested his memory on a wide variety of tasks to see what his baseline abilities were. After that, we had little contact for a while, until one day he called me and complained that he'd reached a plateau. No matter how much he practiced, he couldn't improve the speed with which he memorized the order of a randomly arranged deck of cards. I gave Josh some advice about getting past a plateau, and he went back to training. The whole story is told in his book, Moonwalking with Einstein. But the bottom line is this: Josh did indeed speed up considerably, and he ultimately won the 2006 USA Memory Championship. The plateau Josh encountered is common in every sort of training. When you first start learning something new, it is normal to see rapid, or at least steady, improvement. And when that improvement stops, it is natural to believe you've hit some sort of implacable limit. So you stop trying to move forward, and you settle down to life on that plateau. This is the major reason that people in every area stop improving. I had run into this very problem in my work with Steve Falloon. Steve had been stuck at about the same number of digits for several weeks and thought that he might have reached his limit. Since he was already beyond what anyone else had ever done, Bill Chase and I didn't know what to expect. Had Steve gone as far as one could possibly go? And how would we even know if he had reached some upper limit? We decided to do a little experiment. I slowed down the rate at which I read out the digits. It was just a minor adjustment, but it gave Steve enough extra time to hold on to significantly more digits than he'd ever managed before. This convinced him that the problem was not the number of digits, but rather how quickly he was encoding the numbers. He believed that he might improve his performance if he could just speed up the time it took him to commit the digits to long-term memory. At another plateau, Steve found that he was consistently messing up a couple of digits in one of his digit groups when he was given strings of a certain length. He was worried he might have reached his limit on how many digit groups he could recall correctly. So Bill and I gave him strings that were 10 or more digits longer than he'd ever managed to remember. He surprised himself by remembering most of the digits, and in particular remembering more total digits than he'd ever done before, even though he wasn't perfect. This showed him that it was indeed possible to remember longer strings of digits, and that his problem was not that he had reached the limit of his memory, but rather that he was messing up on one or two groups of digits in the entire string. He started focusing on encoding the digit groups more carefully in his long-term memory, and he rose above that plateau as well. What we learned from Steve's experience holds true for everyone who faces a plateau. The best way to move beyond it is to challenge your brain or your body in a new way. Bodybuilders, for instance, will change the types of exercises they are doing, increase or decrease the weight they're lifting or the number of repetitions, and switch up their weekly routine. Actually, most of them will vary their patterns proactively, so they don't get stuck on plateaus in the first place. Cross-training of any sort is based on the same principle. Switch off between different types of exercise so that you're constantly challenging yourself in different ways. But sometimes you try everything you can think of, and you're still stuck. When Josh came to me for help with his card memorization, I told him about what had worked with Steve, and we talked about why. We also talked about typing. People who learn to type with the classic 10-finger method, where each finger is assigned to certain keys, will eventually reach a certain comfortable speed at which they can type maybe 30 or 40 words per minute with relatively few mistakes. This is their plateau. Typing teachers use a well-established method to get past such a plateau. Most typists can increase their typing speed by 10 to 20% simply by focusing and pushing themselves to type faster. The problem is that as their concentration lags, their typing speed returns to the plateau. To counter this, a teacher will typically suggest setting aside 15 to 20 minutes a day to type at this faster speed. This does two things. First, it helps the student spot challenges, such as particular letter combinations, that slow down their typing. Once you figure out what the problems are, you can design exercises to improve your speed in those situations. For instance, if you're having a problem typing OL or LO because the letter O is almost directly above the letter L, you could practice typing a series of words that contain those combinations. Old, cold, roll, toll, low, lot, lob, locks, follow, hollow, and so on, over and over again. Second, when you type faster than usual, it forces you to start looking ahead at the words that are coming up so that you can figure out where to place your fingers in anticipation. So, if you see that the next four letters will all be typed by fingers on your left hand, you can move the correct finger on your right hand into place for the fifth letter ahead. Tests on the best typists have shown that their speeds are closely related to how far ahead they look at upcoming letters while they type. Although both typing and digit memorization are very specialized skills, the methods of getting past a plateau used in the two areas point toward an effective general approach to plateaus. Any reasonably complex skill will involve a variety of components, some of which you will be better at than others. Thus, when you reach a point at which you are having difficulty getting better, it will be just one or two of the components of that skill, not all of them, that are holding you back. The question is, which ones? To figure that out, you need to find a way to push yourself a little, not a lot, harder than usual. This will often help you figure out where your sticking points are. If you're a tennis player, try playing a better opponent than you are used to. Your weaknesses will probably become much more obvious. If you're a manager, pay attention to what goes wrong when things get busy or chaotic. Those problems are not anomalies, but rather indications of weakness that were probably there all the time, but were usually less obvious. With all of this in mind, I suggested to Josh that if he wanted to speed up the pace at which he could memorize the order of a deck of cards, he should try to do it in less time than it normally took, and then look to see where his mistakes were coming from. By identifying exactly what was slowing him down, he could come up with exercises to improve his speed on those particular things, instead of simply trying over and over again to produce some generalized improvement that would decrease the amount of time he spent on an entire deck of cards. This, then, is what you should try when other techniques for getting past a plateau have failed. First, figure out exactly what is holding you back. What mistakes are you making, and when? Push yourself well outside of your comfort zone and see what breaks down first. Then design a practice technique aimed at improving that particular weakness. Once you've figured out what the problem is, you may be able to fix it yourself, or you may need to go to an experienced coach or teacher for suggestions. Either way, Pay attention to what happens when you practice. If you are not improving, you will need to try something else. The power of this technique is that it targets those specific problem areas that are holding you back, rather than trying this and that and hoping that something works. This technique is not widely recognized, even among experienced teachers, even though it might seem obvious as described here, and is a remarkably effective way to rise above plateaus. Maintaining motivation. In the summer of 2006, 274 middle schoolers traveled to Washington, D.C. for the Scripps National Spelling Bee, which would eventually be won by Carrie Close, a 13-year-old from Spring Lake, New Jersey, with the word Ursprache in the 20th round. My students and I were there to find out what set apart the very best spellers from the rest. We gave each contestant a detailed questionnaire about their study practices. The questionnaires also included items designed to assess the contestants' personalities. Spelling contestants have two basic approaches to preparing for a contest: spending time alone studying words from various lists and dictionaries, and being quizzed by others on words from those lists. We found that when the contestants first started out, they generally spent more time being quizzed by others, but later they relied more on solitary practice. When we compared how well the various contestants did in the B versus their study histories, we found that the top spellers had spent significantly more time than their peers in purposeful practice, mainly solo sessions in which they focused on memorizing the spelling of as many words as possible. The best spellers had also spent more time on being quizzed, but the amount of time they spent in purposeful practice correlated more closely with how well they did in the spelling bee. What we were really interested in, however, was what motivated these students to spend so much time studying the spelling of words. The students who win the regional competitions and go on to compete in the National Spelling Bee, even those who don't end up among the top spellers at the event, put in incredible amounts of practice time in the months before the competition. Why? In particular, what drove the very best spellers to put in so much more time than the others? Some people had suggested that the students who had spent the most time practicing did so because they actually liked this sort of studying and got some sort of pleasure out of it. But the answers the students gave to our questionnaire told a very different story. They didn't like studying at all. None of them did, including the very best spellers. The hours they had spent studying thousands of words alone were not fun. They would have been quite happy to do something else. Instead, what distinguished the most successful spellers was their superior ability to remain committed to studying despite the boredom and the pull of other, more appealing activities. How do you keep going? That is perhaps the biggest question that anyone engaged in purposeful or deliberate practice will eventually face. Getting started is easy, as anyone who has visited a gym after New Year's knows. You decide that you want to get in shape, or learn to play the guitar, or pick up a new language, and so you jump right in. It's exciting. It's energizing. You can imagine how good it will feel to be 20 pounds lighter, or to play Smells Like Teen Spirit. Then, after a while, reality hits. It's hard to find the time to work out or practice as much as you should, so you start missing sessions. You're not improving as fast as you thought you would. It stops being fun, and your resolve to reach your goal weakens. Eventually, you stop altogether, and you don't start up again. Call it the New Year's resolution effect. It's why gyms that were crowded in January are only half full in July, and why so many slightly used guitars are available on Craigslist. So, that's the problem in a nutshell. Purposeful practice is hard work. It's hard to keep going, and even if you keep up your training, you go to the gym regularly, or you practice the guitar for a certain number of hours every week, it's hard to maintain focus and effort, so you may eventually stop pushing yourself and stop improving. The question is, what can you do about it? In answering that question, the first thing to note is that despite the effort that it takes, it certainly is possible to keep going. Every world-class athlete, Every prima ballerina, every concert violinist, every chess grandmaster is living proof that it can be done, that people can practice hard day after day, week after week, for years on end. These people have all figured out how to get past the New Year's resolution effect and make deliberate practice an ongoing part of their lives. How did they do it? What can we learn from expert performers about what it takes to keep going? Let's get one thing out of the way right up front. It may seem natural to assume that these people who maintain intense practice schedules for years have some rare gift of willpower or grit or stick-to-itiveness that the rest of us just lack. But that would be a mistake for two very compelling reasons. First, there is little scientific evidence for the existence of a general willpower that can be applied in any situation. There is no indication, for example, that the students who had enough willpower to study countless hours for the National Spelling Bee would show the same amount of willpower if they were asked to practice the piano or chess or baseball. In fact, if anything, the available evidence indicates that willpower is a very situation-specific attribute. People generally find it much easier to push themselves in some areas than in others. If Katie became a grandmaster after 10 years of studying chess and Carl gave up on the game after 6 months, does that mean Katie had more willpower than Carl? Would it change your answer if I told you that Katie spent a year practicing the piano and then quit before she started chess, while Carl is now an internationally renowned concert pianist? This situational dependence calls into question the claim that some sort of generic willpower can explain an individual's ability to sustain daily practice for months, years, and decades. But there is a bigger, second problem with the concept of willpower, one related to the myth of natural talent, which we will discuss later in Chapter 8. Both willpower and natural talent are traits that people assign to someone after the fact. Jason is an incredible tennis player, so he must have been born with this natural talent. Jackie practiced the violin for years, several hours each day, so she must have incredible willpower. In neither case can we make this determination ahead of time with any likelihood of being right, and in neither case has anyone ever identified any genes that underlie these supposed innate characteristics. So there is no more scientific evidence for the existence of individual genes that determine willpower than there is for the existence of genes that are necessary for succeeding in chess or piano playing. Furthermore, once you assume that something is innate, it automatically becomes something you can't do anything about. If you don't have innate musical talent, forget about ever being a good musician. If you don't have enough willpower, forget about ever taking on something that will require a great deal of hard work. This sort of circular thinking, the fact that I couldn't keep practicing indicates that I don't have enough willpower, which explains why I couldn't keep practicing, is worse than useless. It is damaging in that it can convince people that they might as well not even try. It is much more useful, I believe, to talk about motivation. Motivation is quite different from willpower. We all have various motivations, some stronger, some weaker, at various times and in various situations. The most important question to answer then becomes, what factors shape motivation? By asking such a question, we can home in on the factors that might boost the motivation of our employees, children, students, and ourselves. There are some interesting parallels between improving performance and losing weight. People who are overweight generally have little difficulty starting a diet program, and they will generally lose some weight on it, but almost all of them will eventually see their progress stop, and most of those will gradually regain the weight they lost, putting them right back where they started. The ones who are successful in losing weight over the long run are those who have successfully redesigned their lives, building new habits that allow them to maintain the behaviors that keep them losing weight in spite of all the temptations that threaten their success. A similar thing is true for those who maintain purposeful or deliberate practice over the long run. They have generally developed various habits that help them keep going. As a rule of thumb, I think that anyone who hopes to improve skill in a particular area should devote an hour or more each day to practice that can be done with full concentration. Maintaining the motivation that enables such a regimen has two parts: reasons to keep going and reasons to stop. When you quit something that you had initially wanted to do, it's because the reasons to stop eventually come to outweigh the reasons to continue. Thus, to maintain your motivation, you can either strengthen the reasons to keep going or weaken the reasons to quit. Successful motivation efforts generally include both. There are various ways to weaken the reasons to quit. One of the most effective is to set aside a fixed time to practice that has been cleared of all other obligations and distractions. It can be difficult enough to push yourself to practice in the best of situations, but when you have other things you could be doing, there is a constant temptation to do something else and to justify it by telling yourself that it really needs to get done. If you do this often enough, you begin practicing less and less, and soon your training program is in a death spiral. When I studied the violin students in Berlin, I found that most of them preferred to practice as soon as they got up in the morning. They had set up their schedules so that there was nothing else to do at that time. It was set aside specifically for practice. Furthermore, identifying that period as their practice time created a sense of habit and duty that made it less likely they'd be tempted by something else. The best and the better students averaged around 5 hours more of sleep per week than the good students, mostly by taking more time for afternoon naps. All of the students in the study, the good students, the better, and the best, spent about the same amount of time each week on leisure activities. But the best students were much better at estimating how much time they spent on leisure, which indicates that they made more of an effort to plan their time. Good planning can help you avoid many of the things that might lead you to spend less time on practice than you wanted. More generally, look for anything that might interfere with your training and find ways to minimize its influence. If you're likely to be distracted by your smartphone, turn it off. Or better yet, turn it off and leave it in another room. If you're not a morning person and you find it particularly difficult to exercise in the morning, move your run or your exercise class to later in the day when your body won't fight you so much. I've noticed that some people who have difficulty getting started in the morning don't get enough sleep. Ideally, you should wake up by yourself, that is, without an alarm to wake you, and feel refreshed when you do. If that's not the case, you might need to go to bed earlier. While any given factor may make only a small difference, the various factors add up. For purposeful or deliberate practice to be effective, you need to push yourself outside your comfort zone and maintain your focus. But these are mentally draining activities. Expert performers do two things, both seemingly unrelated to motivation, that can help. The first is general physical maintenance, getting enough sleep and keeping healthy. If you're tired or sick, it's that much harder to maintain focus and that much easier to slack off. As I mentioned in Chapter 4, the violin students were all careful to get a good night's sleep each night, and many of them would take an early afternoon nap after their morning practice session. The second thing is to limit the length of your practice sessions to about an hour. You can't maintain intense concentration for much longer than that, and when you're first starting out, it's likely to be less. If you want to practice longer than an hour, go for an hour and take a break. Fortunately, you will find that as you maintain your practice over time, it will seem easier. Both your body and your mind will habituate to the practice. Runners and other athletes find that they become inured to the pain associated with their exercise. Interestingly, studies have found that while athletes get acclimated to the particular type of pain associated with their sport, they do not get acclimated to pain in general. They still feel other types of pain just as acutely as anyone else does. Similarly, over time, musicians and anyone else who practices intensely get to the point where those hours of practice no longer seem as mentally painful as they once were. The practice never becomes outright fun, but eventually it gets closer to neutral, so it's not as hard to keep going. We've just seen several ways to decrease the inclination to stop. Now let's look at some ways to increase the inclination to continue. The motivation must, of course, be a desire to be better at whatever it is you are practicing. If you don't have that desire, why are you practicing? But that desire may come in different forms. It may be completely intrinsic. Say you've always wanted to be able to make origami figures. You don't know why, but it's inside you. Sometimes the desire is part of something larger. You love listening to the symphony, and you've decided that you would really like to be part of that, a member of an orchestra, contributing to that amazing sound and experiencing it from that perspective. But you don't have an overriding desire to play the clarinet or the saxophone or any other particular instrument. Or maybe it's for totally practical, extrinsic purposes. You hate public speaking, but you recognize that your lack of speaking skills is holding you back in your career, so you decide you want to learn how to address an audience. All of these are possible routes of motivation, but they aren't, or at least they shouldn't be, your only motivators. Studies of expert performers tell us that once you have practiced for a while and can see the results, the skill itself can become part of your motivation. You take pride in what you do. You get pleasure from your friends' compliments, and your sense of identity changes. You begin to see yourself as a public speaker or a piccolo player or a maker of origami figures. As long as you recognize this new identity as flowing from the many hours of practice that you devoted to developing your skill, further practice comes to feel more like an investment than an expense. Another key motivational factor in deliberate practice is a belief that you can succeed. In order to push yourself when you really don't feel like it, you must believe that you can improve, and particularly for people shooting to become expert performers, that you can rank among the best. The power of such belief is so strong that it can even trump reality. One of Sweden's most famous athletes, the middle distance runner Gunder Hag, who broke 15 world records in the early 1940s, grew up with his father, a lumberjack, in an isolated part of northern Sweden. In his early teen years, Gunder loved running in the woods, and he and his father became curious about how fast he could run. They found a route that was about 1,500 meters long, and Gunder ran that course while his father measured his time with an alarm clock. When Gunder was done, his father told him that he finished the distance in 4 minutes 50 seconds, a remarkably good time for that distance in the woods. As he would later recall in his autobiography, Gunder was inspired by his performance to believe he had a bright future as a runner. So he started training more seriously. And indeed, he did go on to become one of the world's premier runners. It was only many years later that his father confessed to him that the actual time on that day was 5 minutes 50 seconds, and that he had exaggerated Gunder's speed because he was worried that Gunder had lost some of his passion for running and needed to be encouraged. The psychologist Benjamin Bloom once directed a project that examined the childhoods of a number of experts in various fields. One of his findings was that when these future experts were young, their parents would use various strategies to keep them from quitting. In particular, several of the experts told of a time in their youth when they were sick or injured in some way that prevented them from practicing for a significant amount of time. When they eventually resumed practicing, they weren't nearly at the same level they had been at before, and, discouraged, they wanted to quit. Their parents told them that they could quit if they wished, but that first they needed to keep practicing enough to get back to where they were. And this did the trick. Once they'd practiced for a while and gotten back to where they were, they realized that they could indeed keep getting better, and that their setback was just temporary. Belief is important. You may not be lucky enough to have someone do for you what Hogg's father did for him, but you can certainly take a lesson from the expert performers that Bloom studied. If you stop believing that you can reach a goal, either because you've regressed or you've plateaued, don't quit. Make an agreement with yourself that you will do what it takes to get back to where you were, or to get beyond the plateau, and then you can quit. You probably won't. One of the strongest forms of extrinsic motivation is social motivation. This can take several forms. One of the simplest and most direct is the approval and admiration of others. Young children are often motivated to practice a musical instrument or a sport because they are looking for their parents' approval. Older children, on the other hand, are often motivated by positive feedback for their accomplishments. After having practiced long enough to reach a certain skill level, they become known for their abilities. This child is an artist, that child plays the piano well, and that one is a phenomenal basketball player. And this recognition can provide motivation to keep going. Many teenagers, and more than a few adults, have taken up a musical instrument or a sport because they believed that expertise in that area would make them more sexually attractive. One of the best ways to create and sustain social motivation is to surround yourself with people who will encourage and support and challenge you in your endeavors. Not only did the Berlin violin students spend most of their time with other music students, but they also tended to date music students, or at least others who would appreciate their passion for music and understand their need to prioritize their practice. Surrounding yourself with supportive people is easiest in activities that are done in groups or teams. If you're part of an orchestra, for example, you may find yourself motivated to practice harder because you don't want to let your colleagues down, or because you're competing with some of them to be the best at your instrument, or perhaps both. The members of a baseball or softball team may collectively push to improve in order to win a championship, but they will also be aware of the internal competitions with other members of the team and will likely be motivated by those competitions as well. Perhaps the most important factor here, though, is the social environment itself. Deliberate practice can be a lonely pursuit. But if you have a group of friends who are in the same position, the other members of your orchestra, or your baseball team, or your chess club, you have a built-in support system. These people understand the effort you're putting into your practice. They can share training tips with you, and they can appreciate your victories and commiserate with you over your difficulties. They count on you, and you can count on them. I asked Per Homloff what would motivate a 70-something-year-old man to devote many hours every week to earning a black belt. He told me that he first became interested in karate because his grandchildren had started training, and he enjoyed watching them and interacting with them as they trained. But what drove his training over the years was his interaction with his fellow students and his teachers. Much of karate training is done in pairs, and Per explained that he'd found a training partner, a woman about 25 years younger whose children were also training in the school, who was exceptionally supportive of him and his advancement in karate. Several young male students in his school were also supportive, and these compatriots provided his strongest motivation to keep going. In my most recent communications with Per, in the summer of 2015, when he was 74, I learned that he and his wife had moved near the mountains to Ura, the Swedish equivalent of Aspen, Colorado. He had reached the level of blue belt and had been planning to test for his brown belt, but since he no longer had the opportunity to train in a karate school with other students, he had decided that he had to give up on his advancement toward black belt. He still trains each morning with a routine his sensei developed for him, a routine that includes warming up, karate forms, work with kettlebells, and meditation, and he regularly hikes in the mountains. His life goals, he wrote me, are wisdom and vitality. Which brings us back to Benjamin Franklin again. As a young man, he was interested in all sorts of intellectual pursuits, philosophy, science, invention, writing, the arts, and so on, and he wished to encourage his own development in those areas. So at 21, he recruited 11 of the most intellectually interesting people in Philadelphia to form a mutual improvement club, which he named the Junto. The club's members, who met each Friday night, would encourage each other's various intellectual pursuits. Every member was expected to bring at least one interesting topic of conversation, on morals, politics, or science, to each meeting. The topics, which were generally phrased as questions, were to be discussed by the group in the sincere spirit of inquiry after truth, without fondness for dispute or desire of victory. In order to keep the discussions open and collaborative, the Junto's rules strictly forbade anyone from contradicting another member or expressing an opinion too strongly. And once every 3 months, each member of the Junto had to compose an essay on any topic whatsoever and read it to the rest of the group, which would then discuss it. One purpose of the club was to encourage the members to engage with the intellectual topics of the day. By creating the club, Franklin not only ensured himself regular access to some of the most interesting people in the city, but he was giving himself extra motivation, as if he needed any, to delve into these topics himself. Knowing that he was expected to ask at least one interesting question each week, and that he would also be answering others' questions, gave him extra impetus to read and examine the most urgent and intellectually challenging matters in contemporary science, politics, and philosophy. This technique can be used in nearly any area. Put together a group of people all interested in the same thing, or join an existing group, and use the group's camaraderie and shared goals as extra motivation in reaching your own goals. This is the idea behind many social organizations, from book clubs to chess clubs to community theaters, and joining, or if necessary, forming such a group can be a tremendous way for adults to maintain motivation. One thing to be careful about, however, is to make sure that the other members of the group have similar goals for improvement. If you join a bowling team because you are trying to improve your bowling scores and the rest of the team is mainly interested in having a good time, with little concern about whether or not they win the league title, you're going to be frustrated, not motivated. If you're a guitarist looking to improve enough to make a career out of music, don't join a band whose members just want to get together in someone's garage on Saturday nights and jam. But do keep in mind that Junto would be a really good name for a rock band. Of course, at its core, deliberate practice is a lonely pursuit. While you may collect a group of like-minded individuals for support and encouragement, still, much of your improvement will depend on practice you do on your own. How do you maintain motivation for hour after hour of such focused practice? One of the best bits of advice is to set things up so that you are constantly seeing concrete signs of improvement, even if it is not always major improvement. Break your long journey into a manageable series of goals and focus on them one at a time, perhaps even giving yourself a small reward each time you reach a goal. Piano teachers know, for example, that it is best to break down long-term targets for a young piano student into a series of levels. By doing this, the student gets a sense of achievement each time a new level is attained, and that sense of achievement will both add to his or her motivation and make it less likely that the student will become discouraged by a seeming lack of progress. It doesn't matter if the levels are arbitrary. What matters is that the teacher divides up what can look like an infinite amount of material to learn into a series of clear steps, making the student's progress more concrete and more encouraging. Dan McLaughlin, the golfer of the Dan Plan, has done something very similar in his quest to reach the PGA Tour. From the start, he broke his quest into a series of stages, each devoted to a particular technique. And at each step, he developed ways to monitor his progress so that he knew where he was and how far he'd come. Dan's first step was learning how to putt, and for several months, the putter was the only golf club he handled. He created various games in which he would repeat the same attempts over and over again, and he kept close track of how he did in these games. In one early game, for example, he would mark off 6 spots that were each 3 feet from a hole and distributed evenly around the hole. Then he would try and sink the ball into the hole with putts from each of these 6 spots, and repeat that 17 times for a total of 102 putts. For each set of 6 putts, Dan counted how many times he got the ball in the hole, and he recorded the scores on a spreadsheet. In this way, he could watch his progress in a very concrete way. Not only was he able to tell what sorts of errors he was making and what he needed to work on, but he could see, week by week, just how far he had progressed. Later, after Dan had learned to use the other golf clubs one by one, first a pitching wedge, then the irons, the woods, and finally the driver, He would play his first full round of golf with a complete set of clubs in December 2011, more than a year and a half after he had started. And by this time, he was recording his progress in several different ways. He kept track of his driving accuracy, how often his shots that were hit off the tee landed in the fairway, how often they missed to the right, and how often they missed to the left. He kept track of the average number of putts it took to get the ball